listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-MC?
McGill. It is MC.
The Mist Chancellor.
The Mist Master?
That'd be the MM.
Mist Master McGill.
It is the 22nd of November, 2022, and this is episode 130 of Comparing Campaign, the podcast where we compare and contrast campaigns of the past, or more accurately, these days, I talk about campaigns, my D&D campaigns that I've been running since 5th edition came out, or well past that. We're on like the third one in a row. That I'm explaining episode by episode. And meanwhile, McGill, when he's not chiming in on my contributions to the episode and picking my brains about my style of DMing and whatnot, he's bringing over some new games, and we just alluded to it earlier, but City of Mist is, I think, are we wrapping it up today?
That's right, in our RPG Danger Room segment, where I test drive different aspects of other role-playing game systems besides D&D, I've been doing City of Mist, exploring the Powered by the Apocalypse-driven RPG City of Mist, and we have looked at the mechanics of City of Mist, we have generated a character, we've formed a small crew. And on this episode, I'm going to wrap up the segment because, I mean, it could go on and on and on. I could probably do like a whole podcast just about any one of these given RPG systems because there are so many like context specific rules and things like that. But on this show, I'm just going to talk about the last few of the big mechanics in City of Mist that you need to know about before you play. And then we're going to do just one more of those questionnaires because there's one fun little like offshoot extra thing that you can do with the questionnaire with the theme book that I think will be fun. And then, yeah, we'll wrap it up on City of Mist.
I kind of want to like play through a little scenario with you for like just for the sake of it with City of Mist. Like maybe we do a little scene or something with our characters. I feel like I wanted to do that with Burning Wheel, but then things really rolled the fuck away from us.
Got overcomplicated with the combat. All right. Well, then let's call this the penultimate City of Mist episode, where I finish off a few key rules and we generate something that we can use in the scene that we'll play on our next show. How's that sound?
That Burning Wheel rolled the fuck away from us just like a burning wheel would.
It really did. I didn't expect the three different forms of combat to each basically be their own, like, self-contained minigame.
Whatever. So I am technically not... I'm just picking up where I left off last episode, because I realized last episode that there was so much content in the operation that I was describing that our party was... engaged in, that it ended up like, and also the module that I'm basing it on was split into two parts, so I sort of saw the split coming up and I was like, you know what, I'm gonna save the second part for next time. And so that's what I'm gonna be covering today. The players are still in the Citra Arha realm of Maritime. They've just rescued a character by the name of Zamiel to help. He's like a Nightside Eclipse scholar who's supposed to provide critical intel relating to the demonic invaders that are attacking Citra Arha. And so the players have managed to get him and bring him back with the intel in his head to the sort of fortress where they landed at this realm. But now that they've secured that objective, it has given them the opportunity to go up to the higher echelons of that fortress with their contact Satariel and put them in contact with some of the higher authorities around who will have some ideas of their own for the players. But McGill, I have something very off the beaten path to talk to you about that I just felt like talking about. And, you know, maybe this will lead up time, but whatever. I just felt like I've been up all night. I'm kind of sleepy. I don't know. My sleeping's been all over the place lately. It's been real hard to record an app because I keep sleeping through all the regular times. So I don't, I don't even know if I mentioned on the podcast is like my friend is running a game where basically it's like every act of his campaign, the players travel to a different major RPG setting. And so I can say that, like, the first setting they went to was, like, Shadowrun, and the second one was Forgotten Realms, and the third one was, I think, some sort of, like, prehistoric jungle planet. And now they're in World of Darkness, and I'm doing a cameo of sorts, sitting in on those sessions while they're in the World of Darkness to act as kind of a personification of the World of Darkness. Basically, it was like the DM had the idea to use that setting as one of these arcs. But then he was asking me about it, and he was asking about like cool stuff from the setting that he could involve in the campaign and stuff. And like, I was kind of pointing out like the thing about World of Darkness is that it's basically just our world, but with vampires and werewolves and stuff. Like, we talked before when we covered it on the podcast, like, there's campaigns that take place in, like, Toronto and Ottawa and stuff. Like, it'll be take place in, like, New York or Boston. Like, you know, it's not really its own world. And even with that said, like, neither is Shadowrun technically. Like, I think technically they were in, like, Seattle when they went to Shadowrun. But whatever the case, it basically became a thing of, like, first we were looking for what we wanted, how to represent World of Darkness in that this campaign in a compelling way. Because, well, again, it's like, you know, drop some.
So,
yeah.
Am I understanding correctly that, like, you are playing almost like a deity, like an avatar of the deity that controls?
Not really.
The plane of existence that is World of Darkness?
It's more accurate to say that, like, I am most of the NPCs in the World of Darkness. Is like, because the DM is not as familiar with the setting as me, and so he cannot answer questions that characters might get asked about the setting as quickly and as easily as I can. And so it'll be like, you know, the players are going around. So I guess also to just establish is what we decided, because I was like, well, there's the old World of Darkness and the new World of Darkness, and again, they're both kind of like nebulous, but what's not nebulous is the sort of crossover point, which was when they declared that when White Wolf declared that Old World of Darkness was ending and had ran the, like, published the End Times books, which basically gave like apocalypse scenarios or like end game scenarios for each of the main game lines. And so it's an excuse to basically have the players drop into the World of Darkness and immediately be confronted with, like, all of the craziest elements from the game. It's like, so, again, what I was going to say there is, like, they get into, like, this ruined, like, war-torn, martial law version of New York City. There's a big red star in the sky, a big chunk has been blasted out of the moon, it looks like. There's, like, toxic dust cover blotting out the sun, but this red star and the silhouette of the moon are still visible. And there's these, like, spec ops teams just, like, hunting people down in the streets, like, gunning people down, detaining them. But then, so then the players come down in all this, and they're like, what the hell's going on? And then they, like, see one of these spec ops teams hunt down a person, and one of them's like, hey, I'm going to stop those bad guys. And then a werewolf comes out of nowhere and, like, tears the special ops teams apart. And then the players are like, what the heck? And they, but maybe they try to ask questions of the werewolf, and, like, I know better in that moment what the werewolf is aware of than the DM. And so he just says, over to you, Tom, and that I play the werewolf in that scene. I have like main sort of anchor NPCs that we have designated that I am playing, but I have also volunteered this ability to just sort of like play any NPC at a moment's notice. But like, for example, the anchor character, the first anchor character that I have, they land in New York City. And they run into a bunch of crazy encounters that, you know, introduce them to various World of Darkness monsters and things. But then Nosferatu pops out of a manhole and is like, what the hell are you guys supposed to be? Because this is the other thing about this campaign is it's like, the idea is that the players are like the biggest badasses from across the multiverse assembled into a team by Mordenkainen. So the team is like a caveman, a wolfman, a like Fabio ass looking paladin, a character like basically a character from Destiny, and like a dragonborn cyborg. And so like I play this Nosferatu who's supposed to be the guy that like basically says like, yeah, well, there was a big red star in the sky and then things all start going downhill from there. But here, let me see if I can get you some intel. And leads them down into his base in the sewers. But yeah, when he sees all of them, it's just like, oh man, a bunch of fucking aliens. Now what's happening?
You know what this reminds me of? Did you ever see the movie Anomalisa?
No, but that's the Kaufman? Is that it? Kaufman?
Yeah, it's a Charlie Kaufman stop motion animated, like, drama, surreal drama, also produced by Dan Harmon of all people. But one of the gimmicks in it is there are the two main characters who are played by David Thewlis and Jennifer Jason Leigh, and then in the credits it says and Tom Noonan as everyone else. And so the actor Tom Noonan plays literally every supporting character aside from the two main characters. This is kind of what I'm getting from the dynamic you're describing here, where it's sort of like there's the main party, there's the DM, and everyone else is Tom.
Yeah, kind of. But again, it's more for just like to provide a service to the DM so he doesn't have to like dig into piles of lore and go down a million rabbit holes about a bunch of pseudo biblical, pseudo animist, pseudo Eastern philosophy nonsense. That is the bread and...
Yeah, definitely better to call in an expert.
The bread and butter of Old World of Darkness. But, so the thing is, in getting involved in this project, I have, you know, I can't help myself. I myself am getting drawn deeper and deeper into the lore of Mage. And it's just been like, it's one thing after another, because it's like, this game happens, and then I feel like I should be looking up more stuff so that I can be more informative for the DM. And, like, we're sort of, like, the end, like, we're sort of doing all the, like we're basically doing one of the vampire apocalypse scenarios in New York. Then they're going to the Outback, where we're doing one of the sort of mage endgame scenarios, but also mixing it with, like, werewolf. And then there's like a big finale, and for that we're taking that straight from the Mage finale book. And so with that, like, the further we get into it, the more I end up digging more and more into that lore and going down those rabbit holes myself. And that has in turn led to me like getting that hankering of like, or getting that idea at least of like, man, I would like to play Mage. I do like the idea of Mage. It's like,
Tom,
is this whole
we're about to we're about to play a game of Teeth, and you're already thinking about two games away.
Yeah, I know. But actually, this is kind of different, because I think in this case, I'm really thinking more in terms of if I was a player than if I was running a game. Like, I think in reality, if I considered it seriously, chances are I would have to run the game if I was going to get a game of Mage going. But, like, I think what it draws me on to, also, that way you just, like, admonished me, like, Tom, we're just about, that's literally what that girl that's mad at me for looking at the other girl in the meme sounds like. You're, like, communicating her rage as being my regular D&D game that I'm getting distracted from. Four Teeth, I should say.
We can't play RPGs fast enough to keep up with Tom's desire to play new RPGs.
Well, and I mean, this is a real thing. This used to be a real problem that I had, is like back when, there was a time when I was with my ex where I, like, it was, my thing was that, like, every other week I'd get into a new RPG and drop the one we were doing. And it was, like, the thing is, I've talked about this before, it's, like, one of the reasons I pride myself so much on my ability to follow through on a very long arc now is, like, I used to have this big problem where, like, I never actually reached the really cool parts of any RPG I played because I was always so busy getting distracted by new ones that I'd only like get a taste for them and never really get into them to the full extent. But with, so like with, there's Mage the Ascension, which is the old World of Darkness. And that's what I've had to dig through for, this game that I'm cameoing. But then there's Mage the Awakening, which, like, if I'm being honest, I always consider myself more of a new World of Darkness guy than an old World of Darkness guy. And so I think about, like, because I think it just started as, like, I was getting into all the different types of mage there are, all the different traditions in Ascension with Raffi. And then I was like, you know, like, I kind of came to a realization. It's also a thing of, like, one of the players in that game, now that we've started doing it, like, had no awareness of Vampire the Masquerade. And so the idea of the vampire clans and everything was totally new to them. And that's, like, a really cool idea to be introduced to for the first time, I think. The way they all have their own powers and weaknesses. And so then I realized with the DM, he, like, Werewolf and Mage were pretty much the same way with him. Like, he knew much more about Vampire than he ever knew about the other games. And what's really funny about Mage relative to those other games is, like, it was actually a thing at one of the sessions, is, like, one of the players explained to another player, like, basically it's like Underworld. And that covers, like, what Vampire and to some extent Werewolf is like, but Mage is more like the Invisibles or the Matrix. It's like,
yeah, we've talked about this before.
Yeah, this idea that, you know, the world is bad because bad people, like, are running reality, but you've been given the power to change reality through magic, and so you're gonna, you know, all the responsibility that entails. And I think just, like, showing the DM all these different mage traditions, I was like, so I got a sense of, like, what clans they liked, but what I was interested, like, I think I said, like, if you were to play a mage, what kind of mage do you think you would play? And the thing is, I asked that, but then I, like, immediately that question sort of reflects back to me, is like, man, what kind of mage would I play? And it's funny, there's something with Mage the Awakening, or at least I think it's something that's true of both, but it's just when I tend to think of like creating a mage, I tend to think of myself doing it in Mage the Awakening. But it's this idea of like with a vampire, when I create a vampire, there is a fairly inherent blueprint for the evolution of that character, similar to having a progression chart for your class in Dungeons and Dragons. It's like when I make a vampire, I generally always know that the type of vampire I'm going to play is one that, similar to what we were talking about with City of Mist, with this idea that my character's like mythos path is what is my final form, is I'm always interested when playing a vampire in like basically becoming a better vampire, and like, you know, whether that means like improving, whether that means controlling my hunger, being able to stay awake during the daytime, even if it's just like hidden in darkness, anything that seems to like subvert one of the limitations of being a vampire. And the idea is to eventually take that to a point where I am like a better kind of vampire, or even like a post vampire, like some sort of like next level. Like it's kind of what inspires the idea of like vampires being beneath liches in the Nightside Eclipse. But the thing is, with mage, like I say that about having the blueprint as a vampire and feeling like it's fairly intuitive. Whereas with mage, I feel like the character is literally given the blueprint and the writing implements like directly. And there is like the seismic consequence, like the mage, when they are when they first awaken to the reality of magic, they don't realize how that blueprint works or how changing it is going to affect the world around them. But the seismic consequence of that responsibility or the implications of that are pretty clear from the beginning. Like if you tell somebody that reality as they know it is a fabrication, and then you tell them that they are going to be able to alter that fabrication, I think it's like, it's a bigger thing to lay on someone than even, hey, you're a vampire now. Because it's like, and what it really comes back to is the thing is that the idea of playing, like, mage really appeals to me on that level. But as a player, confronts me with a kind of genuine existential angst that vampire I don't deal with. Where it's like, the way I kind of phrase it is like, vampires just have to figure out how they're going to live in the world. Mages have to actually run it. Like, they actually, the end game for a mage is like, okay, you are like a master of reality, of the universe. Like, and so what do you do with that? And it's like, the possibility are kind of endless. And one thing that's funny is, I think that in Old World of Darkness, even as a player, I tend towards like the bad guy versions of the different game lines. So for example, the Zemitzi. Actually, we talked about the Zemitzi in a previous episode, you know, the fleshcrafter vampires. They are like kind of the most direct manifestation of that idea of like post-vampirism. Like they're whole nature is based on the idea of changing yourself into something new. And so when I look at Old World of Darkness with that view of like, I want to make a vampire that's trying to become something more than they are, the Zemitzi immediately jumps out at me for that. But the Zemitzi are supposed to basically be like they're the clan that exists for like villains to play, basically. Like they have a power that basically turns them into a boss monster. Similarly, with mage, I find that what I'm drawn to, like, I think in the scope of that idea of like you are given like authorship over reality, I think I would have a tendency to always be leaning towards this idea of a mage who's just like, their mind is just like shattered by that power, or it's like a mage that basically is so enthralled by the idea of the void that's basically like has basically been given these tools of authorship over the universe and sees the whole potential and expanse of the universe and is like, wow, it's so full of like everything, so what could possibly be more mighty than the void, which can undo all of it? And it's like, this guy is just like, what could be better than the thing that cancels out everything? Like, just a real student of oblivion. And that also, like, fits into an archetype in Mage the Ascension anyway, called the Nefandi, which are basically, like, dark mages who, like if in Mage the Ascension, it's like... a mage, their end goal is ascension, to become an archmage and to become this master of reality. But for the Nefandi, their goal is actually descent. They want to become like one with the void, basically, and become this like instrument of pure nothingness. And it's funny. So in Mage the Ascension, the Nefandi have their own dark side version of all the like mage versions of magic that the mage characters normally use, and those are called the Cliffoth. And it's worth noting that if you look up Citra Arha in Wikipedia, it redirects to the article on Cliffoth. So it's all coming together, man. I mean, in fairness, I think Citra Arha basically means dark side. But, yeah, I think even in Mage the Awakening, which has sort of different archetypes in it, or different factions, like it doesn't have the Nefandi in the same way, I think even in that setting, there would be a tendency for me to play this, like, this mage that's just, like, wants to enthrone nothingness triumphant. There's a concept called pralaya. It's like Sanskrit. I think it literally means destruction, and it's also like taken or tehom, the Hebrew term for the void, I think, like as in darkness was on and dark was null, the world was null and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, whatever it was. I should remember that better. Point is, like, yeah, I just want to, I like the idea of being, like, the one super warped mage in, like, a group of, like, existential freedom fighters who's actually, like, oh, man, I'm just, I just love that oblivion, man. Give me that pralaya. Let the thousand suns disperse and free us from the chains of the universe, etc. And yeah, that's been my whole, I've basically been up all night reading about different types of Mage the Awakening paths that study the lower depths and the abyss. Cool stuff like that. I will say, saying that thing about the Zemitzi in like Vampire the Masquerade, is like, I don't really get the same thing in Vampire the Requiem, because in the Requiem, there's the Ordo Dracul, which are basically like a mainline vampire philosophical / science group that is like all about like improving your like overcoming the vampiric condition and like improving upon it.
I will say, you know, I don't, I wish you well in getting enough sleep, and I'm sorry to hear your sleep schedule is all out of whack. But I do kind of love the idea of Tom, you know, like some crazed wizard in the wee hours of early morning twilight flipping through tomes of mage rules.
Yeah, I mean, that. Yeah, it's kind of what was happening. It's like, you know, yeah, I don't really know how to phrase what I was trying to say just now. It's like,
this is the side effect of a weird sleep schedule.
Yeah, it's just that, like, you know, it was a funny thing. Basically, I have a friend who's sort of getting into, like, a new thing, like, a new lifestyle, almost, basically. And they're sort of, like, really thrilled at the experience of, like, the introduction to it and all the things they're learning and everything. And hearing that, they were talking to me about that last night while I was doing this mage stuff, and I'm like, man, it sounds like you're getting into the stuff I'm getting into, but for real. Some real Invisibles type shit. My friend's figuring out the real code to reality, like some Snow Crash stuff. Meanwhile, I'm here playing goofy games.
Playing goofy games and eating joke snacks.
Oh man, I'm kind of low on supplies these days, actually.
Oh, get on it. Gotta get you some joke snacks.
I gotta get me
get
some food in general.
Get thee to the joke snackery.
I gotta get some food in general. Anyways, yeah, I don't know. Like, I guess the thing is, like, as an outsider of these games, like, I don't know if this resonates with you at all, is this idea of, like, the existential angst that comes with being a mage that I, like, genuinely kind of stare down every time I even consider, like, what kind of mage I would play.
I'm gonna go with no. No, I don't get that.
You know, actually, I was talking to my brother a bit about it, and one thing, he said something that I thought was very profound, which was that he said that playing as Valfarine Draeglin guy, he never felt truly magical until he got access to the wish spell. And I think that really taps into something about the difference between magic in Mage and the magic in Dungeons and Dragons. Is like, in Mage, you are engaging with magic on such a creative level that you feel way more like you're actually, you know, interfacing with magic, like you are a wizard. Whereas in Dungeons and Dragons, magic is very prescribed. Like, the spells are detailed as they are to fit within the scope of the rules. But that does kind of fail the fantasy of, like, the potential, the endless potential of magic that I think Mage really engages with in a neat way. What do you think about that?
I mean, that's neat. I don't know, what kind of thought are you looking for on that one?
I guess it's just like, I think my brother's statement is like, with it wasn't until Wish that he could basically make up his own effect for a spell. And that's like pretty much the core of what Mage is about, is you like learn the different types of magic and then you craft your spells by like combining them and applying them in certain ways. I don't know. Do you ever feel like you wish you could play a game with like a more like full on magic system that you could get into?
Magic has always been a sort of a weird spot for me in D&D. I don't tend to play magic users, and I don't know. I think the issue lies sort of somewhere in between these two poles that you're talking about, you know, like D&D magic or mage style magic rules, in that I don't know, it always feels like almost too regulated. Even the idea of crafting spells, I don't really like. I almost wish there was an even more freeform kind of magic mechanic that would allow the player to dictate the effect that they're trying to create more often, or I don't know. It just seems like a magic system is always so difficult to define and regulate, to the point where even magic as described in pop culture, like, I don't know, like Harry Potter magic or whatever, doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, there's not a lot of logic to it, and It's always tricky for me to nail down. So really, like, I never play wizards. If I have to play a spellcaster, I'll play a sorcerer, because I like at least the freeform nature of not having to plan ahead for what spell, like, prepare spells in advance. But, I don't know. It's an interesting question to level at me, simply because I generally just don't do the magic thing in RPGs, because none of the proposed systems I've run into really fit with what I want to do, you know? How I like my magic to flow, if that makes any sense.
Personally, I think the mage system is really great. You've got 9 spheres of arcana, and they're all according to different things. So you have the arcana of mind, or the arcana of forces, the arcana of entropy, or prime. And, you know, you mix these in various combinations. It's like, you know, maybe you mix it. Maybe you got a bit of mind and you got a bit of prime. And prime is like magic. It's like meta magic. So if you have mind and prime, then you could make yourself like a magical barrier that protects your mind from intruders, maybe. That sort of thing. But it is very much like kind of what you were describing. It's like you try to figure out what the effect is first, and then you see whether you have the abilities, like whether you have the mastery over the different elements of reality to make that happen, or, you know, what you can.
Kind of sounds like the RPG version of that video game Magicka. Did you ever play Magicka?
I never played it, but I'm familiar with it.
Because in Magicka, it's been ages since I played it, so I might be getting this wrong, but you have like a set number of different like elements to draw upon, and you create your spells basically by like typing on a keypad, you know, between you make combos out of the different sources of energy to create spell effects.
I thought Tyranny was a game that had pretty good spell customization as well, although it was a lot more limited. So, I think we've been going for a while here. As much as I'd like to keep talking about mage and wacky magic systems, I think we better get to my side of things. So, continuing in Maritime, as I said, they brought Zamiel back to the fortress, and Saitaril has brought them up into the upper echelons of the fortress's command structure. Security zone restricted to only those Nightside Eclipse could be trusted, as demonic corruption had thrown previous systems of security clearance into chaos. Here, the party met 2 individuals leading the Nightside Eclipse resistance in Maritime. Gog Shiblaw, who appeared as a monk concealed in hooded black robes, similar to Zamiel, but with the decoration of medals and badges on his chest resembling a decorated officer. The other agent was Calliope, a woman in spiky Greco-Roman gladiatorial looking armor, was apparently a high authority figure within the bureaucracy of the Nightside Eclipse. And I already foreshadowed this a bit last time, but basically, Gog Shiblaw had a highly dangerous mission for the party: to travel into the heart of the demonic base in Maritime and capture not one, but 2 live demonic fire giant super mutants. Advanced specimens, no less, further altered than the others the party had faced. With these 2 captives, Gog Shiblaw, Zamiel, and Saitaril be able to study the demonic mutations and formulate a way to overcome them. However, Calliope had an even further request: a show of force in the heart of the demonic base to shake their morale. If, for Calliope, the party infiltrated the demon's Colosseum, a place to slake their bloodthirst in the ruins of the once thriving heart of Maritime, and survived the arena, making a mockery of the invader's strength, the party could get a favor from Calliope, and Calliope was in the position to offer a unique and highly desirable favor in the form of a treaty of non-aggression against Drail from the Nightside Eclipse, lasting until at least the end of the demonic conflict in Sitra Arha. So, it's like, all right, you saved the scholar we need to figure out this demon invasion. Now you can meet the higher ups, but they've got a you know, they've got some quests of their own for you. They got some high level missions for you. And for Zamiel and Saitariel and Gog Shebla, like, they're all sort of on one team now. They're like, all right, well, Zamiel's got the intel we need on the demons. Now what we need is live specimens that we can experiment on. But then Calliope, she says, and while you're there, if you can survive in the arena of the demons and, like, stick it to them just by not dying in their arena, then you'll have a favor from me. And that favor, knowing Calliope's station in the Nightside Eclipse, they are informed that they can turn that favor in to ensure that the Nightside Eclipse will basically sign a non-aggression pact against Drail. Should be a hell of a thing after all these years of Nightside Eclipse occupation in the Deathlands. So the area of Maritime the demonic forces occupied was similar to the area the Nightside Eclipse loyalists had been pushed back to. A port on the edge of the Black Waters, but the one the demons now controlled was more akin to a bustling port city than a mere defensive outpost. Thankfully, the party was small enough to scurry past patrols of fire giant guards unnoticed with relative ease, so long as they kept their distance. The trick was that they couldn't use their jetpacks, lest they draw the attention of every demon and mutant in sight. Early on in their infiltration of the city, the party encountered an imp named Pip, who recognized the scent of a good berry. That's Mephile's bloodline going all the way back to Mealy.
I just want to say, so there's an imp named Pip, but are they going to encounter a pimp named Ip?
Nope. But this imp named Pip, he recognizes the scent of Mephile's bloodline and defers to Mephile as a superior in the hierarchy of Mephisto's agents, which tells the party that Mephisto apparently had this spy deployed to this location. But it's a funny thing of basically, like, they meet this little devil in Citra Arha, and they're like, hey, what the hell's going on here? And the imp's like, oh shit, leave me alone. Hey, wait a minute. Wait. You smell like my superior. Ah. Because Mephile's bloodline has been cutting deals with Mephisto devils for, like, years now, remember? So it's this thing of, like, Mephile doesn't actually... Like, Mephile's on pretty bad terms with Mephisto these days. But this imp just knows their bloodline as, like, being in good with Mephisto, so he immediately assumes that Mephile is, like, his superior in the field. Pip even impressed the party in combat. They were just shy of taking out a giant at one point, and Pip dropped a dagger on its head, finishing it off. They were like, Pip, help us out. And he was like, I got this knife. He drops it on the giant's head, does, like, one HP, kills the giant. Amazing. With Pip's help, the party navigated the demon-infested city, a period of unprecedented danger for the party. At an altar the demon lord Gratzt, the party captured their first super mutant, but only after a battle with that mutant, another, and three Glabrezus, which required a redo after one attempt to run the encounter online went horribly wrong, as I was attempting to run Gent in Chantel's absence, and I deemed it an unfair outcome, and thus my willingness to rerun the scenario. But I'll tell you, I mentioned that this was going to be relevant in this operation, is we were talking about Glabrezus recently. Yeah? You remember?
Yeah, we were. They're the ones that have two sets of arms and, like, lobster claws and can fly with magic, right?
Yeah. So, in this disastrous run of the encounter, there was a point where basically Gent had the captive secured and was like, okay, I am just going to, like, try. Like it was a thing where basically I was like, okay, Gent is going to try and, like, flee from the combat and just sort of, like, get the captive away so that part of the operation can't be compromised anymore, so that you, like, definitely have the captive. But when Gent did that, Connor thought, like, everybody was taking off. So Connor, like, I don't know, people start to hit fly and try to, like, fly away. But then I'm like, okay, the Glabrezus fly after you. And it's like, what? Dagus, three Glabrezus just jump into the air flying after you when you try to fly away. That is no good. Also, waste of an action casting fly to try and get away from a creature that already flies. Nonsense. But despite this, this was nothing compared to the grueling series of fights that the party had to overcome in the Colosseum. For something like 3 sessions, the party faced all that the demons could throw at them, some putting their skills to the test, some a feeble mockery that tested their cruelty. At one point, when presented with enslaved drones to fight, Gent refused to participate, while Hexakila used his jetpack, grabbed the slaves, zoomed up to, like, the concert box that, like, the demon running the Colosseum was in, and, like, cast the pathetic undead down at the feet of the super mutant running the Colosseum, demanding that the giant handle his own executions and not waste the party's time and prowess. Finally, the master of the arena was goaded into coming down into the ring, and in the chaos that exploded following his public defeat, the party was able to extract him as their second captive, fleeing the city directly with their enormous prizes. So they got 2 live fire giants. But, you know, they've got things like the Iron Bands of Bellaro, which can be used, like, you throw... It's like one of those elastic band balls, but when you throw it, it unfurls into, like, a bunch of chains that then wrap around your target and, like, constrict them. They had, like, abilities, like, they had dimensional shackles. They had ways of, like, if they could knock out one of these giants, they could basically secure them. But there's also something that happened towards the end in the Colosseum for an added effect of, like, crazy chaos in the Colosseum. I remember I mentioned at some point already in this campaign that the players at one point got a hold of a bag of beans. Remember that?
I remember the bag of bean.
So, I think it was Hexakila or someone planted one of those beans right in the middle of the Colosseum arena when, like, things were going crazy. And
did a beanstalk grow?
No. They got one of the other results. I'm just going to look it up here. Okay, 91 to 99. A pyramid with a 60-foot square base bursts upwards. Inside is a sarcophagus containing a mummy lord. The pyramid is treated as the mummy lord's lair, and its sarcophagus contains treasure of the DM's choice. So, they done created a pyramid with a mummy in it, right in the arena before they left. Like, take that, you stupid demons.
Bye.
Yeah, and you know, as I mentioned, they're coming back to Citra Arha now. I'm going to have to see how things turned out with that mummy.
It's still there.
Wonder if that mummy will acknowledge that they brought it into this horrible place. The effort was worth it, though. By defying the demons in their own territory and securing the captives, the party had ensured a policy of non-aggression towards Drail from the Nightside Eclipse, as well as providing the residents of Citra Arha with a hope of defeating the invaders' fearsome shock troops. And after this, Gutbones provided the means to return to Drail, but revealed that he intended to remain in Citra Arha to take his place among the Nightside Eclipse resistance against the demonic invasion. Returning to Drail, with their temporal position maintained throughout the tour of Citra Arha using Gutbones' assistance, the players had a debriefing and some well-earned downtime to look forward to. And that's how the Act 3 of Coyote's Aegis, Swarth, came to an end. That was how their Citra Aurora tour ended.
Whoa!
They done got a non-aggression pact from the Nightside Eclipse for Drail. Because Nightside Eclipse has bigger fish to fry now. Good news for Drail, yeah. Huh?
That is good news for Drail. And damn. Another act down.
Yeah. Just, I mean, if we're ending Act 3 now, I'm currently running Act 6.
Catching up quick.
It's getting, I don't know, it's getting a little too close for comfort, I'll tell you that much.
What are we going to call this podcast when we catch up to the present and you've run out of notes on campaigns?
Well, I mentioned in a previous episode, like, theoretically, I will still be running my game, like, week to week. And so, theoretically, it can become a podcast where I just talk about what happened in the session every week.
Yeah, but then if you miss a week, then the show's got nothing. We got to rebrand it. It's going to be like recap and RPG Danger Room.
Yeah, and like it'll be sloppier because like I'll have to go. Well, it'll be sloppier in the sense that the episodes won't be designated to individual operations or adventures, but it will also help in that I'll be able to bring like literal things that came to me that week in that session. Like I'll have a better frame of reference for what happened in the session because will have happened just like a week before. By the way, I'm also seeing in my notes here just something that I like noted down just as a reminder to myself because I had this idea and I'm like, man, that's good. I gotta hold on to that. It's an idea for a sci-fi mage game campaign chronicle, which would be a follow-up or spiritual successor to Space Vampirates, and I call it Ships of the Magi. What do you think of that?
I think that's also awesome, but where are you going to find the time?
Yeah, it's just something about this idea of, like, for some reason I had this idea in my head of, like, a bunch of mages that are, like, in a spaceship, and they're going out to, like, you know, discover the secrets of reality and, like, be custodians of the universe using their power. But then they're like, another mage ship is coming by and they're like, drop out of warp. And I'm like, oh man, that'd be cool. Mages dropping out of warp. That's fucking cool.
Mage warp. All right, Tom. Is it time? Da 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 da
da da da da da da. Not me.
MC.
It's a bit early this time, but I mean, I went pretty long on goofy mage stuff and everything.
MC.
Oh, you know, one thing I will also say about mage stuff is, like, I didn't get this sense so much with Vampire. With Vampire, there's a sense of, like, I can look through the options and get a be pretty certain of, like, what kind of vampire I want to be. But in Mage, it's like every bit of lore that I read or every Wikipedia article that I read or every little sidebar that I read in a book reveals to me something about the setting or like some thing about the Mage setting that I like, it hits me like, oh shit, I didn't know about that. Maybe that's what I really want to be into. And it's this idea of like with the mage setting, it's like there is more, it goes deeper than I could possibly like comprehend at the outset. Like I think with vampires, there is like a limit to what you can expect from vampires. Whereas like, yeah, with mage, it's like every weird revelation in Mage seems to like redefine something about the world in a way that it's like, oh, maybe I wouldn't, maybe like it really feels like I would be exploring that path in the same way that my mage was by going through the game lore and playing the game, because it's this thing of like, you know, maybe I create my character and I think that I want to be this like crazy void mage, but then along the way I find something related to the void that's different, that is even cooler to be and even more like specifically my jam, and then I'm like, oh shit, I should actually be on that path, and then I like switch over to that. Like, it's, I don't know. It's this idea of like mage being like a journey of learning in a way that like vampire isn't necessarily, because the rules of being a vampire usually remain the same throughout.
I can dig it. Man. So when were you gonna play mage?
Man, I don't know. I mean, the idea was to do Scion World of Darkness, remember?
Yeah, you were talking about that one for a while.
Like, if I'm gonna do one, I guess I'm gonna do that. And just have mages in it, maybe? I don't know.
Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Not me.
So we've gone over ultimately everything with everything we've talked about regarding City of Mists thus far. As a player, you would have enough to dive in. Your MC, like, you got enough on your sheet there that your MC can call for something, call for a role, and you know what to reference. We've talked a bit about like the different moves that you can take. We've talked a bit about statuses, gaining and losing statuses. So you've got the tools that you would need to play a game. And since you've requested that we play a scene, I'm going to put one together for our next episode. So we will do the game. We'll have the game in action. But the last few things that I wanted to talk to you about is, I don't know what you'd call them necessarily. I guess the best way to refer to these effects and ideas is to reference the tracking card. There's one more thing that players sort of have to equip themselves with in a game of City of Mist, and it's a bunch of these blank tracking cards. I guess you could print off a bunch and have them like a communal stack that people can draw upon. And these tracking cards are used for a few things. You can see, looking at the image of them that I sent you, up in the top right corner there are four different icons. So the one on the far right that looks like a little medical bag, that is a status. Next to it, to the left of that, the one that looks like a little tag is a tag, a story tag, or a power tag, rather. And then there are two more there. The one that looks like a battery is for a mechanic called juice points. And then the magnifying glass is for clues. And all of these function, they're almost like in-game currencies. They're points that you gain and spend to accomplish different things. Now, we talked about power tags, we talked about statuses, so I'm going to talk about clues and juice. So first up, clues. City of Mist is a game that is always concerned with investigation. So you and your crewmates are searching for answers to strange cases. I mean, your guy, Agent Cross, right? Special Agent Cross, he's a paranormal investigator. He's always on the case. Incidents that can't be explained, happenings that hide deeper truths, events veiled by the mist, the titular mist. So to uncover the truth, you have to put one and two together, follow the trail of breadcrumbs, and that trail is represented by clues. They're a game resource that can be traded for information. The most common way to receive clues is to use a move, the investigate move. It generates clues. Some other moves also grant clues. They're a resource that are possessed by the player, and they're not the same as like evidence or information, although they are related. So you gain clues. The rules will tell you how many clues you gain. You know, one, five clues, whatever. Every clue or batch of clues has a method and a source that are determined by the action you took to receive clues. The method is the means that you use to obtain the information, and the source is where you got your information. So, for example, if you're researching a deity by going through old books in the Old Quarter Library, then the method of obtaining your clues is research, and the source is the Old Quarter Library. Another example, if you have a conversation with Jimmy Rudolphy, a reluctant witness of a murder, clues generated will have the method as questioning, and the source is Jimmy Rudolphy. So the method and source of your clues are used to track the origin of each set of clues. If you wish...
Are there any standard methods, or what is the other one?
Sources.
Like, so you mentioned method questioning. Is that something like from a list, or do you just make them as you need to?
You make them up as you need to. They're all context sensitive. But like something like interrogation can obviously be used in all sorts of settings and stuff like that. But the idea here is that when you are gaining clues, you can track them on one of your tracking cards and note down. You see, so the tracking card, again, at the top, it has those four icons. You mark off the icon representing it. So I've got a tracking card here for research that I'm doing in the Old Quarter Library. I'm gaining some clues, so I circle the little magnifying glass on my tracking card. And then in the blank space to the right of where it says tag, you put down the method and the source. So the method is research. The source is the Old Quarter Library. And you will have used a move action to generate your clues. So something like investigate. And let's say I got three clues off of my investigation, off my research. So you can also search or circle the three on your tracking card. And there you've got a little tracking card to track the clues of the case that you're working on. You can't change the method or the source of the clues you have. You can only obtain new ones using different methods or different sources. Then you can spend clues to learn more about the subject of your investigation by asking the MC questions. So you can ask any question you can think of. You're questioning that Jimmy Rudolphy guy? Who's the killer? It's a valid question. Is the witness telling the truth? Where was the witness at the time of the murder? What does the witness think about me? The only caveat for asking questions with clues is you can't use your clues to ask for information that can't be obtained using the method you used. So, like, you can't ask, what are the witness's repressed childhood traumas? Because you can't read their mind. But you could, in theory, if your method was, like, therapy, for example, it could be therapy. You could use that to learn the answer.
Or
to that
mind
question.
Reading.
Mind reading, exactly. Yeah, mind reading, totally valid as a method, so long as your character has the ability to read minds.
And that leads me on to something, which is the idea of like, can your power tag be used as a method?
You know, I don't see why not. Certainly, in conjunction with a method, I could see it. Do you have, like, an example in mind looking at Agent Cross's power tags?
The example I was thinking of was honestly just, like, if I created a character that could read minds, then that would probably be a power tag somewhere, but then I could use it as my method.
Absolutely. There's no real cross-pollination in this case. Like, the method and the source are really just points of reference so that you can, when you look at your tracking card, you can go like, oh yeah, I did that research at the library, so I have clues related to this case. So, mind reading? Yeah, absolutely a valid method. So, in response to your question, the MC will provide information based on the case that they have prepared. The MC doesn't have to expose the whole truth. The MC can give you a straight answer or a solid lead. A solid lead is a useful detail that when combined with other details will point you towards the answer. So like if you asked who's the killer, the straight answer would just be like Jackie the barmaid. But a solid lead could be there aren't any signs of there aren't any signs of a struggle, so the victim knew the killer. So this does cut a bit of slack to the MC, to the game master, just so that, you know, if they've concocted a mystery, they don't have to right away reveal the big secret, like, right off the bat, because their player got a clue. There's a bit of wiggle room for the MC to just keep things moving on without disruption and without tipping their hand too badly. So the MC will provide information based on the source of your clues, the books in the library, what Jimmy Rudolphy knows. The MC cannot lie or provide false information. They have to speak the truth, even if not the whole truth. And there are, of course, some exceptions to this, but that's just like getting into the nitty-gritty. When the MC provides the answer or lead, he also translates it into the story, describing how your character obtains or deduces this information. So it's just, it's sort of like narrative prompts in a way. You're giving the player the ability to move the game forward, move the plot forward, and prompt the MC to just tell the next part of the story with these new revelations in mind. So here's like an example from the book about doing research in the Old Quarter Library. There's a character named Declan Lestrange, and he says, "I'll spend a clue from my library research. Tell me, MC, who is the modern-day manifestation of the evil deity?" And the MC goes, "You read through the academic books and transcriptions in Spanish, German, Spanish and German for hours, before you suddenly stop on a page showing an ancient Aztec symbol associated with Xochiquetzal, a goddess Tezcatlipoca, once kidnapped. You remember the symbol. It was tattooed on the shoulder of the lady at the cocktail party." And then Declan goes, "She can lead me to him." So you got some information there, and you got a strong lead, but this is a case where the MC did not just like straight up say, the modern day manifestation of the god is that lady at the cocktail party. Instead, the MC has pointed the player in a direction that the story will go. So that's sort of how clues work. You never know how much of the information the MC chose to reveal, or whether it was a straight answer or a lead, unless the MC chooses to divulge that. If the MC reveals interesting information, you can ask about that too, and, you know, pursue a line of questioning with the MC using the clues that you're spending. A clue is considered spent only if you receive an answer or lead. If you can't get an answer or lead, then the clue is not spent. So this is another way that the MC can avoid being forced to tell the players too much. You know, you don't find out, so you don't lose the clue. The MC has the final call on whether an answer to a clue is useful enough to consider the clue spent. And one last thing is that you can obtain clues by investigating other players. When you spend clues, the player of that character provides the answers instead of the MC, and all the same rules apply. While your characters may lie in the story, as players, you must provide truthful information, a straight answer, or a lead. Most of the time, you'll be spending your clues the moment you get them. However, you do have the option to keep the clues you gained for later. Your clues retain their method and source. The method used to obtain them is source, as it was when you conducted your investigation. When you spend clues later, the questions you can ask and the answers you can get are limited by the method and source. You can't use your banked clues to ask questions on a different subject. Spending banked clues could be described by flashing back to your conversation with the witness and remembering additional details, or reviewing your notes from your research at the library and finding more information that way. But they're always associated with that method and source. That's sort of the way of keeping the nebulous idea of clues, because, you know, the clues represent bits of information, but if you don't have the bits of information, you have to at least anchor them to something in the story. Clues expire when the information they represent becomes obsolete. You know, if you scope a graveyard for dangers and gain clues, they expire when you leave the graveyard. If you come back, you got to scope the graveyard out again to see if there are new dangers lurking there. So there is a limited window on your clues. So you got all that? You understand how they work? Did I lose you, Tom? Are you muted?
I said, I don't know. I'll have to find out and play, I think.
Of course.
I did have my mic off.
Yeah, I mean, obviously these will fully gel when you play a bit. But clues just being sort of a method of gaining information. And frankly, this is another case where after reading about how they work, I found myself going like, I like that a lot more than just like investigating in D&D. Because my players tend to do a lot.
The currency of clues is very cool. The idea of like you can measure your gains and then trade them in, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And use them strategically to, you know, you could bank a clue from a source that you know is going to be important later. And then when it comes up, you can be like, I got one clue left relating to my library research now that I've finally confronted the evil deity. So what is the deity's weakness? And, you know, oh my God, flashing back to the library, you were flipping through the tome. And on the back of the page describing the ancient deity's origin, it said the deity's weakness. You pull it out at a key moment. And then, in a similar vein, another one of these sort of give-and-take currency-style point systems is juice. The scenes you play in City of Mist are dynamic and dangerous. As an investigator, a vigilante, a criminal, or just someone trying to survive in the city, you need to be able to take actions that change the battlefield in your favor. Rallying your crew, leading them out of a cult's underground complex, conjuring a pack of wraith-like wolves from the abyss. These are all in a day's work for a rift like you. Juice points represent your ability to shape what is going on around you by using your abilities, resources, and allies. They can stand for an advantage in battle, a healing touch, psychological stability, or even just general preparedness when you pull out just the right equipment out of the back of your pickup truck. They can also reflect mythical resources like a cloud of elemental power, the power to conjure beings and items, or spells you dig up from your grimoire. In game terms, juice points allow you to create and remove story tags, give and remove statuses, burn other players' tags, giving you immense freedom to use your character's abilities creatively. And the most common way to receive juice points is, again, by using a move. One of the moves is called Change the Game, and that grants juice. There are other moves and game options that grant juice too, but one of the most common ways is to use a Change the Game action. When you gain juice, the rules tell you how many juice points you get. Every batch of juice points that you receive has a method. Again, it's the means that you use to gain that advantage in the specific circumstances in which you did so. Your juice's method is determined by the action you took to gain it. If you open a crate of weapons in the middle of a downtown shootout, handing out gun after grenade after gun to your henchmen, then the method is dispensing arms out of a crate. If you summon the restorative powers of Gaia in an effort to heal your fellow investigator, your method is healing powers. So again, similar sort of idea to the method with your clue, except this one can, in a way, be more closely associated with your power tags, I would say. You know, if you got a power tag that's like an arsenal, I think you had access to an arsenal or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
got it right here.
So there you go. So like
secret arsenal.
So if you are, you know, if you're handing out guns from the arsenal, then the method of the juice you receive for doing so is arsenal, dispensing guns from your arsenal. You can then spend your juice at any point in the game, before, during, or after a move made by you, another player, or the MC. For your juice to affect another player's move, you must use it before the dice are rolled on that move. The effects you wish to generate with your juice must fit its method and the circumstances in which you are using it. If your method was healing powers, you can't use your juice to conjure a suitcase full of money. It's gotta be what you said it was. If you're an ordinary paramedic patching up a crewmate in the heat of battle, the MC may rule that you can't heal the injuries completely, only reduce the pain and provide first aid. Juice points can be spent to activate one or more of the following options. So here are things that you can do with your juice points. You can create a new story tag. You can add a new temporary story tag to the scene. For example, you can empty an oil tank from your speedboat to create an oil spill. Oil spill being the new story tag. You can call the police. The police being a story tag. Call your lawyer for legal advice. Legal advice being the story tag. Another thing you can do with juice is you can burn a tag. For each juice point spent, you can burn a temporary or ongoing story tag, removing it from the scene. So you can lie to the police and make them leave, for example. Alternately, for each point of juice spent, you can temporarily burn a power tag belonging to a fellow player's character or a permanent story tag. A temporarily burnt tag is recovered after the target makes any one move. If this option is made ongoing, using the move Change the Game, so you can make it a more permanent tag, the tag is burnt for real and has to be recovered using the normal methods for recovering tags, usually like resting, basically. We've talked about that. You can't spend juice during another player's turn to burn a tag they invoked on their move. You can give a status, pretty self-explanatory, what we've talked about, those temporary statuses like, shocked, dazzled, things like that. You can reduce or remove an existing status. And those are the options for ways to use juice. And then you can also, similar to clues, you can bank juice. Since you can only use juice to create effects that are related to its method of generation, most juice expires soon after it's generated as its method becomes obsolete. You know, if you suck the alcohol out of a drunk crewmate or crewmate with the drunk status and get 3 juice, the remaining juice would expire immediately because once the alcohol is out of the drunk crewmate, they're sober and so your method is gone. Your banked juice retains its method until you use it or until it expires because its method becomes obsolete. You can use it at any time appropriate to your method. While you have juice banked, you cannot generate more juice using the same method. All the game elements you use to create this batch of juice, power tags, story tags, statuses, any other game options, are locked down. They can't be used to generate more juice until you have spent all your banked juice or it expires. You can also discard your bank juice at any time, and batches of juice points are never stacked together. You can't add them to make a bigger batch. So you track your juice using a tracking card. And, you know, there are little side rules here. There are some, optional rules. You can recover a burnt tag using juice, for example, as if you want to use this optional rule. One of the things that you can do with juice is... is recovering a burnt power tag. But for the most part, it functions exactly as I described. And those are sort of the last two holes in the starter knowledge for City of Mist. Obviously, this book goes on and on. There's a lot more stuff that we could cover. But really, I often feel like the point of the RPG Danger Room is just to give a primer on an RPG system, maybe see how a few things work, character generation, you know, basically get someone ready to play this game without them having to know every single rule.
Yeah, but I think I'm really going to struggle to understand these things, like, until I, like, experience them in... play, you know?
And we're gonna
okay.
We're gonna do it. I will try.
Because, like, the character we created and what I just learned, they're still separate in my head because I learned them at different times, you know? It's like, I could apply some of what you were saying to what... some of what I knew to what you were saying, but then there were other stuff where I was like, I need to see this in action.
I mean, that's fair, and I often find I pick up games a lot better seeing them in action as well. But at least this way we've got sort of a primer on just the basic mechanics, the basics of play. But there's one more thing that I want to do with you, Tom.
Okay.
And let me just pull up my...
Do you want me to eat up some time while you're doing that? Because I got a little thing that popped up.
Sure.
So a long time ago at Fantasia, I saw this movie called Resolution. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, I've seen Resolution. You know,
man. So now they just, on my Facebook, they did a Q&A with Mike Flanagan about their new movie.
There's something
I met
in the
these
dirt,
guys,
right?
Aaron and Justin. Yeah, I met Aaron and Justin at Fantasia.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
I have a photo of me that makes me look really short because I'm standing off the sidewalk and they're on the sidewalk. But there wasn't enough room on the sidewalk, so there you go. I didn't realize they have... Did you see their movie The Endless?
I did.
I didn't realize it's like theoretically a Resolution sequel. I didn't even know they had other movies. I hadn't heard about them. I hadn't heard about none of them since Resolution. And that was in 2012, damn it.
It's like a... Way back. Like a sidequel, man. Yeah, their latest one sounds pretty funny as well. It sounds like their madcap quarantine project.
Yeah, so what did you have to pull up while I was eating away the time there?
So there's one more thing. This is like an extra theme book thing. It's not... it's like an add-on. It's like a supplement. So what you can do in City of Mist is there are rules for doing... Like generating a theme card, like we did for our characters, like we did for our crew, but you can generate it for your base of operations.
Oh, sick.
So I thought it might be fun. Let's generate a base of operations for Team Fondue.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so here's page one, and this is it. We know the method quite well by now. You answer the first question and then choose two more questions to answer. And here, I'll take the notes for this one. I'll note it down on my end.
Okay, so...
So first we need to decide on, like, what's our base? What's our base? Base of operation, the fondue pot?
Yeah, safe house.
But what are we? What do you call it? What do we have a name for our hunter base? Like,
the pantry.
Pantry is good. I really like that. Here,
okay.
There we go. We're gonna go with.
We'll call our safe house the pantry.
Gonna go with the pantry. And, so, you know, some brainstorming questions to begin with. What kind of place would best serve my character's activities? It's a rather regular blank. It's the
safe house.
You figure it's a safe house? Maybe it should be like a hidden sort of safe house, like in the back of a grocery store where Norb works.
I feel like that's because the thing is, like, I thought about the grocery store angle, and I thought about, you know, the agency. But I feel like it should be somewhere that's like neutral ground between our two characters. And so I think having a safe house where we meet and like you're allowed to put your feet up, your stinky feet up, I think that works like as a halfway mark, you know?
So where should our safe house be?
Probably like an apartment downtown.
All right. It's got to be a basement apartment if it's called the pantry.
Okay.
So downtown basement apartment. And the first question on our power tag questionnaire is, what is the most useful feature of your base?
Maybe our, instead of an apartment, it's like a... Maybe it's like a maintenance area down in connected to the sewers. Like something like somewhere similar to like a janitor's office, but like in the sewer system.
Okay, yeah. So like a underground maintenance room.
Yeah.
So its most useful feature is it's well hidden.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, somewhere we can lay low. So, yeah. Discretion.
All right. Discreet.
Safety.
Well, what do you think? Is it more important for it to be discreet or safe?
Safe.
All right. So, safety. And now we got to pick two more questions.
Like, basically, it's a thing of, like, when we go there, we know that other people can't get to us. So, yeah, safety.
Here, I put it as safe and secure is the tag.
I like it. Okay, what special gear do you store in your base? I would say my field loadout. Like, so I have the arsenal back at the agency, but, like, whatever I've chosen as my loadout for this for the mission I'm on.
That's a good idea.
That is, like, ready in the safe house. I was thinking, what defenses or devices protect your base from intruders? I was thinking, like, it's, like, along with that idea of, like, discretion is, it's sort of, like, its ownership is obfuscated by the agency, you know? Like, it's the sort of thing where, like, bad guys can't, like, look us up or find it because it's, like, it doesn't exist.
Oh, hey, I got a good tag for that, off the grid.
Yeah, I think that's good. Except it is, like, very much still in the grid. It's just, yeah, it's not, like, it's not on paper or whatever. Like,
Unlisted? You
know, it's undocumented, unlisted, yeah.
Yeah, unlisted. Okay, wait, so which one of that, what defenses? So that's question B.
Yeah, what defenses or devices protect your base from intruders?
That's good. And now,
or unlisted on databases, maybe.
Let's just have it as unlisted. Like not okay. Even your average, you know, street thug knows about it. It's not like someone can just go asking around.
Yeah, and and then what special gear do you store in your base?
Field loadout.
Yeah.
Awesome. So the pantry is it's a maintenance room that is safe and secure, unlisted, and contains our field loadout. Right, yeah. On.
Underground maintenance room.
And now, much like with the other themes, we gotta pick a weakness.
Oh, yeah.
So choose one of the four weakness questions.
I do love one of the power tag questions. It says, who works or lives in your base? One of the options is 40 thieves. Then under weaknesses, what happens when you spend too much time in your base?
The 40 thieves.
It's really good. you know, honestly, like, with what I was thinking about, like, having it just sort of, like, attached to the sewers. Also, the idea of having, like, a maintenance area. Like, I'm thinking that this place, like, there's, like, a loud, unpleasant droning noise the whole time you're there, and it smells bad. Like, I think it's just, like, uncomfortable in the way that, like, you know, like, a water processing facility would be.
Okay, so maybe the weakness should be sensory discomfort.
Yeah, what condition or negative aspect of your base makes it harder to use? Sensory discomfort. I think that's good.
And that's A. And then, finally, we need to decide on the mystery or identity for the base. And remember that this is just sort of like a guiding phrase or idea. So, as you know, here we have some examples. If it's a private investigations office, your identity might be, I'll take any case that comes through the door. Or if it's the Cave of Ali Baba, it might be, what other questions can I add, or treasures can I add to my collection? So, I mean, mystery or identity, we've sort of already said it. Maybe our the identity of the pantry should be a place to cool your heels, or like a place to hide while things cool off.
I was actually kind of thinking, so this might be a bit extreme, but in brackets saying black site, and then the quote is, this is off the books.
Yeah, I like that. Black site.
It makes it sound like we take fucking people there to torture them or something, which, like, that's more extreme than I want to go for. But I do like the idea of, like, you know, we are, like, elsewhere I may be under the thumb of the agency or whatever, but, like, in the safe house, it's just us running the show.
Yeah. So there we go. There's one, like, last little fun thing that I found in City of Mist. Just this, like, little extra playbook for designing your base of operations.
I also like the idea of this is off the books being, like, also when our characters inevitably spend all night bickering in the safe house. That's also not recorded for the agency. Like, we agree not to tell anybody.
What happens in the pantry stays in the pantry.
Exactly.
And there's a filled-in sample base of operations theme if you're interested in sort of seeing something that we didn't generate.
Dito.
Yeah. And as you can see there, like with any theme, there are improvements that you can implement. There's some cool ones here. I like the idea of booby traps that, you know, when you level up your base, when you improve your base, you can add some booby traps for it. Away from prying
just
eyes.
Stacking, yeah, I was about to say stacking that on top of what we got, I think, is pretty effective.
Yeah, that'd make it an extremely safe little spot. And, I mean, upgrade it twice, away from prying eyes and also peace of mind. Those both seem to go hand in hand with what we were envisioning for the pantry. Like, it's a hidden spot, but it's not hidden so that we can necessarily, like, bring someone there and interrogate them. It's hidden so that we can get away from everybody else and have a bit of peace of mind while we're there.
But we can bring someone and interrogate them if we have to.
So there we go. So there's our primer on City of Mist, and on next episode, I will bring a scenario for us to play through. A Special Agent Alex Cross, or is it Alex Cross? Special Agent Cross. I said Alex Cross because of the show detective. The detective from movies and novels and stuff.
Yeah, I'm just Special Agent Cross.
Special
man.
Agent Cross, and who is a Weir Charmander, and Norb Snodgrass, the grocery store bag boy who doesn't know why he transforms into a being made of cheese. They're gonna run a little scenario together.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of mission old Director Bowman's gonna kick down the pipe to me.
Oh, and I mentioned this to you offline, Tom. But it wasn't until I was editing the most recent episode that I realized that you had created a character and an NPC named Cross and Bowman.
Again, I told you, like, I think that genuinely, because the thing is, I was listening to that episode as well, and I start with a different name. I said that I wanted him to be like Agent Dogs or something. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, like, I think that I legitimately, there was a point where I was like, ooh, maybe I'll go back and take some inspiration from my last character. And then I was like, no, I'll dip to somewhere else. And I did that dogs thing. And then I forgot about that decision and later was like, why don't I just dip back into that old character?
Cross and Bowman.
And then it was something where, like, yeah, I think it's genuinely something where, like, that is where it came from, is, like, the desire to just take something from the last character I had made and turn it into something new. But I think that, like, I genuinely don't think that in the moment I realized that I was literally spelling out the word crossbowman with two of my characters. I think it was just like a weird coincidence that, like, I was like, there's nothing weird about this. And then, like, subconsciously, I can totally see what I was doing.
Now I'm wondering if this is going to be like a recurring thing.
You know, if you want to show, if you want me to show you my math a little bit, the thing is that, like, oftentimes if I'm at a loss for inspiration, I'll just, like, look at something like a big old list. You know, I'm always big. It's like how I, you know, I'm always looking for lists to inspire my RPG, and hence the track lists being what defines the acts in my games. Similarly, so, like, in coming up with Udo as a crossbowman, that was inspired by the, like, figure number one on the original Mage Knight run is an Udom crossbowman. And then, like, Charmander is, like, in the list of Pokemon is Pokemon number one. No, that's not true. Bulbasaur's, no, yeah, I think it's Bulbasaur. I done goofed. Charmander number. Yeah, Charmander's number four. So it was probably Bulbasaur that came before. Whatever the case, you know, if you, I tend to reach for the top of a list. And as we get into more games, maybe I'll go further down those lists. You know?
I'm curious to see where it will all lead.
You know, if Mage Knight Rebellion, if the first three figures are rookie crossbowmen, experienced crossbowmen, and veteran crossbowmen, then maybe my next character has to be a veteran crossbowman in some capacity, in some interpretation of that phrase. A crossbowman.
Now I gotta pick an RPG that is appropriate to that.
I mean, not necessarily. And the thing is, like, ideally, the RPG will put something in my face that, like, inspires me right there and then. Like, that's one of the great things about World of Darkness, is that when they list a type of vampire or mage or whatever, they have a list of suggested character concepts. That's like when we were going through those character concepts for the clans in the Shadows of Mexico, and we were like, oh, we noticed there was, like, one that is, like, specialized to, like, a resort campaign in each entry. Yeah. And, like, but, like, those little lists, that's something that, like, immediately jumps out at me, is like, hey, here's some ideas for characters you could play of this type. And it's like, ooh, that's a list right there. I'll just pick the first thing that's on there. Or the third thing, because I like the number three. You know? Path of three. Whatever. Maybe I'll play them all. That's always the dream, is I start on the first one and I say I'll do them all eventually. When does he ever get to that? I don't play enough games to play all those.
Yeah, now you want to do a mage game.
I got my fucking D&D character queue. It's like multiple pages long.
Jeez.
And I'm barely chipping away at it. Anything else, McGill?
Not me.
Can't just take my line like that. All right. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or follow us, check us out on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials once we get them up, because, again, I haven't been too on top of things lately, but comparingcampaign.wordpress.com is where we generally have our show notes. But we are, like, over 20 episodes behind now, so quite a bit to make up there, and I'll get on it at some point. Who's gonna get on it? Me. not me.
Not me.
I can't do it. Dangus, I can't do it. All right, but don't steal, because it's haunted. Take care, everybody. Thank you.